Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're discussing one of the most celebrated novels of the 20th century, The Great Gatsby, published 100 years ago, and we'll be debating how its themes still resonate today. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Published in 1925, F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby is a story of wealth, ambition, love and loss set against the backdrop of the Roaring Twenties. It was an era of excess, prohibition and shifting social values, but beneath the shimmering parties and grand illusions lies a tale of disillusionment, class struggle and the ultimate failure of the so-called American dream. In tonight's show, we want to explore what makes the book such a well-loved classic a century after its publication. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Philip McGann lectures in the School of Arts, English and Languages at Queen's University Belfast and is an expert on the life and work of F. Scott Fitzgerald. A member of the executive board of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Society, he edited the Oxford University Press centenary edition of F. Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise and is the series editor for Oxford's new centenary editions of Fitzgerald's books. He edited the Penguin edition in the United States of The Great Gatsby and also the expanded Penguin Classics version of the novel, which will be published in April. Dr. Alexandra Peat teaches in the School of English, Media and Creative Arts at the University of Galway and is an expert on modern and contemporary literature, and she's the author of Travel and Modernist Literature, Sacred and Ethical Journeys. Professor Kirk Kernott is Professor of English at Troy University in Alabama and Executive Director of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Society. A leading expert on Fitzgerald, he has written extensively on Fitzgerald's life, work and enduring influence, including An Historical Guide to F. Scott Fitzgerald and The Cambridge Introduction to F. Scott Fitzgerald. Well, you're all very welcome. And Kirk, I might begin with you. It's a much loved book. It's a very famous book. But how great a book is it?
Well, it's a great book. Obviously, I'm biased, but I do think that one hallmark of great literature is it has the capacity to make itself meaningful at any given moment in time. And I think Gatsby has offered us, since it was kind of rediscovered back in the 40s, a lens by which to understand different periods of American history. So, one of the things I'm seeing right now are a lot of essays about what Gatsby can teach us about income inequality, which is currently at the highest it has ever been since the 1920s. So I do think it's great in the ability to draw us in and really make us want to understand our own era, even though it's set 100 years ago.
And Kirk, it's interesting what you say there about it being rediscovered in the 1940s. Is that correct that it wasn't an immediate hit, it wasn't an immediate classic, that it was only in later years that it was maybe rediscovered and taken up and found a new audience?
Yeah, well, it came out in 1925 and it sold less than half of his previous novel. And I think there was an assumption that, you know, whatever was making him famous in his earliest peak years was kind of wearing out, and that he probably would not have a big readership for his novels. I think, you know, a lot of great literature needs a kind of myth to envelop it, to make it meaningful. And so in Fitzgerald's case, there's the tragic irony that he had to die with that book largely forgotten, only to have it be rediscovered, you know, within 5 years of his death.
And Alexandra, when you look at the themes in the novel, so many of them, as Kirk is saying, are relevant today. They do resonate so strongly, the idea of the American dream and what it represents and how it can succeed and indeed how it can fail. Questions about race, questions about wealth, questions about society. Like, there are so many issues there that it's written in 19, it's published in 1925, but it very much speaks to readers in 2025.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one way in which it does sort of resonate very much with our current moment, in that this is a book that was written after the First World War and after the Spanish flu pandemic. So it's a kind of post-pandemic novel that emerges in this period of kind of huge global and national transition. And I think, you know, almost every character in the book is an outsider of some kind. They're all from other places. They're sort of drifting across America. And the novel, I think, speaks very much to anxieties about migration and about race that are extremely current and extremely relevant to America today.
So, Philip, you were involved in editing the Penguin Classics Centenary Edition, and that's going to be published now to mark the anniversary of the publication. And it brings together new scholarship, and it restores Fitzgerald's masterpiece to the original American classic he envisaged. There's a new introduction, and it deals with these issues, sexuality, class, gender and race.
Yes, very much so. So Min Jin Lee, award-winning American Asian-American writer, has done the introduction. And I think it's exactly what both Alexandra and Kirk have been speaking to, that there's a timelessness about the themes and concepts that Fitzgerald is talking about in this novel, which means that while it speaks directly to the 1920s, it is still relevant today. And, you know, that's probably more a comment on or perhaps an indictment of some of the issues that have bubbled to the surface again in the wake of an economic crash in the 1920s. The 2020s and the pandemic, as Alexandra also mentioned. So the book, it's an extraordinarily flexible book. The critic Matthew Broccoli refers to it as being inexhaustible. And it is one of those texts that we can always go back to find something new to discover.
And Philip, do you think that it's also our love of the 1920s and the way we've romanticized that period and the idea of the fashions, the prohibition era and the speakeasies and the glamour of that, that it's been romanticized so much that also is one of the reasons why so many audiences connect with the book, why it's something that has been turned into a musical and a stage show. It's been filmed a number of times, that there is something about that era as well that really we are attracted to.
Yeah, I think there is something extraordinarily captivating about that jazz age period that Fitzgerald himself defined. You know, without Fitzgerald, we may never have romanticized it quite the way we have. There is certainly a sense of vitality, post-war excitement in the New York City of the text. But let's not forget as well, though, that Fitzgerald, while he was the writer of the Jazz Age, he would also be the American writer of the Depression in the 1930s. So I think one of the things for people who are either new to the novel or coming back to The Great Gatsby is to just be really aware of how well Fitzgerald writes his times.
Well, Kirk, talk to us about F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think he was 29 years old when the novel was published. It was his third book. Tell us about him. Tell us about his rise as a writer and what kind of a person he was.
Well, I think it's very important that you mention he was in his 20s when he wrote this, because I think that's part of the sort of the appeal of Gatsby too. Fitzgerald was, you know, he has always been a sort of icon to young writers, and the whole idea that you could embody both a lifestyle and an art. And I think that's a great part of his appeal. It also helps that he's one of our few writers that is, inexorably associated with a spouse. You know, you never speak of just F. Scott Fitzgerald. You have to speak of Scott and Zelda. So there's a whole romantic myth about living your life at a certain fever pitch, and then that is your subject matter. And that's intensely, I think, appealing to especially younger artists when you start out in your 20s. Fitzgerald's, very much a character of contradictions. I think that he grew up instilled with very much a class consciousness, a sense of outsiderness, a middle classness, if you want to think of it that way. And growing up and looking at the world around him where there was a lot of privilege in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he envied that. And it created a sort of both at once a desire to be part of that world, but also a sort of fierce criticism of it. And I think one of the greatest things about Fitzgerald is the ambivalence. I mean, I think one of the things that Gatsby always makes me confront is the fact that personally, I'd love to be rich. I'd love to be Jay Gatsby and have a house and just throw parties and not go to them and have everybody talking about me. But the book also encourages us very much to criticize that idea of lavishness and the waste that money generates. And I think Fitzgerald, that's really the great struggle of his life, is to figure out, was he more of a Victorian or a modernist in terms of his values. So I think you feel that fracture all the way through the novel, especially when Nick says, I was both inside and outside. To me, that's just a perfect way of kind of encapsulating what he accomplished in that novel. And it represented a huge artistic leap for him. His previous novels had been sort of chatty and digressive, and there's a lot of overwriting in them. But he really sort of, I think, assimilated the appeal of modernist symbolism in Gatsby. And it just makes, as Philip said, it just makes the text so endlessly readable. You can go through there and you're always rediscovering a passage that you say to yourself, why have I never noticed this turn of phrase before?
And Kirk, do you think there's elements in it that are autobiographical, or that he takes elements from his life and puts them into his novels?
I do think there's an element of Gatsby and Fitzgerald. It's the idea of, and it's a very American idea, the idea that you can be whoever you want to be, that you invent your ideal self. I mean, Fitzgerald came of age in a period in which there was really a sort of a tectonic shift away from notions of identity and being built upon character and upbringing and class to more of personality. And are you... do you captivate people? Are you interesting? And I think he wanted to be one of the interesting people. So when we read all this stuff about Gatsby lying to people about his background or sort of encouraging rumors, that's very much Fitzgerald, I think, in his own struggle to be a captivating person.
Alexandra, do you think there's an element in it where The Great Gatsby itself is this response to what's happening in the world? It's a response to modernity and modernism, and that it's Fitzgerald wrestling with some of these great big ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the novel is, as I said, it's interested in what this sort of new modern world would look like. And I think one way to understand it is that this is a sort of book about spectacle. I mean, Gatsby himself, his name, The Great Gatsby, the title of the book, it makes him sound like a magic trick or a magician of some kind. And the book was written in what was really a sort of exciting new age of spectacle. So, you know, we can think about all these new forms like skywriting or neon signs or billboards or adverts. And these are all kind of featuring in the novel, these new technologies of looking and seeing. And this is, yes, it's a kind of novel about the invention of these characters, but it's also a novel where people are always gazing at each other or gazing at things. So we have, you know, Gatsby, who's looking out at this green light, which represents Daisy and represents hope. And we also then have Nick, who's kind of watching Gatsby and trying to figure him out. And so I think in some ways, it's a sort of response to this new age of spectatorship, But it's also, I think, a response to kind of anxieties about all these new technologies of vision, you know, like film and photography and cinematography and radiography, all these new kind of emerging modern technologies that led to a kind of anxiety that perhaps you couldn't believe what you see, or perhaps you couldn't trust your own eyes. And there's a lot in the book, too, about things not quite being what they seem. So I think there's that wonderful scene where they're at the party, and of course a party is another kind of form of spectacle. And Nick goes into the library and he finds all of Gatsby's books, which have uncut pages. So they suggest books that have never been read, that are just there to sort of be a display of something. And I think that this idea of a kind of spectacle that's hiding something, or a spectacle that's misleading in some ways, is really central to the book. And in that way, I think it's a book that's quite, in some ways, it's quite pessimistic, right, about the ways in which our dreams trick us, or the ways in which they sort of mislead us or lend false promises.
Kurt, there are also criticisms of The Great Gatsby in terms of some of the racism and xenophobia that's on display there, and some of the things that are said, and some of the language about civilization being under threat, or even the way women like Daisy are trapped by social expectations, that some of those elements have been criticized more in recent years.
Yes, well, I think one of the first things that we struggle with when we're Fitzgerald scholars is the fact that he was on the wrong side of history about race. And, you know, we just have to accept that and not apologize for it, but also not make excuses for it. So I think that Gatsby, there are ethnic stereotypes in there that are very common to the day. Did he intentionally mean to inflict harm by them? We really don't know. But there's been long-running controversies about the depiction of the gangster Meyer Wolfschein, whether that's sort of Shylockian anti-Semitism being depicted there. Clearly, when you have Jewish characters with big noses who are dealing with money, you are trafficking in stereotypes. That said, there was also the emergence in that period of a Jewish mafia. So he's dealing with a lot of these characters that were being celebrated in newspapers in the very same way. I think Alexandra makes a great point when she talks about the, you know, how close the Harlem Renaissance was, but Fitzgerald never participated in that in the way that, you know, some of his fellow revelers like Carl Van Vechten did in documenting those parties. In those nightclubs. But we do have a scene where Gatsby and Nick are crossing the Queensboro Bridge, and they, you know, go by a limousine that are full of what we presume to be, performers at a Harlem nightclub. And you have these African-American performers who look over to Gatsby and all of his exotic car and just kind of roll their eyes very haughtily at Gatsby's desperation. So there are moments that kind of upend our notions of racial stereotypes in here. I think the very fact that we don't know much about Gatsby's background, or specifically whether there are, whether he can be definitively categorized as quote unquote white, also brings a very instructive way to sort of destabilize some of Fitzgerald's own racism in the text and make it interesting to contemporary readers.
Philip, it is fascinating the way you see some of the ideas of Tom Buchanan reflecting, I suppose, the America, the United States of the 1920s and some of the dominant views there, and the way that I suppose Tom has inherited a lot of these ideas, the sexism, the hypocrisy, the selfishness, the racism, and in a way he's almost a voice for the era as well.
Yes, absolutely. Tom is the novel's representative, I suppose, racist character. In many ways, today he would be right central within a MAGA movement. It is a novel that is extraordinarily violent, but not just on the fringes of things, and it all centers around Tom, whether it is his opinions about racism and the rise of the colored empire, whether it is the violence that he inflicts on a number of women in the text, not just his own wife Daisy, who, you know, a small version of violence where she's a bruised knuckle, up to the ultimate violence against Myrtle Wilson, where he breaks her nose and then she herself is collateral damage for his life of affairs and basically bigotry. You know, Tom is a bigot at his heart. And that's one of the things that the narrator of the novel, Nick Carraway, registers very early. So, you know, one of the other really interesting things about how Fitzgerald sets the novel up is that we see everything through the eyes of Nick Carraway. And Kirk mentioned earlier how he is this character who is both, you know, on both sides sometimes. He's within and without, simultaneously attracted and repelled by what he sees in the text. And what we see in Tom Buchanan is a character who is very much of his time, but is also extraordinarily ignorant about his times.
And it's fascinating that about 100 years on, you still have some of these ideas, and even that idea of the Great Replacement theory and what's happening in terms of the United States today. Some of these theories, some of these ideas still being presented, still being debated, still being dominant in the discourse.
Yeah, it's remarkable in so many ways to listen to some of the conversations and some of the discourse today coming out from the White House using, you know, 18th century laws to deport people and talking about a sense of white identity that at its heart has already been passed by. But there's a sort of nostalgia for an America that can never, ever exist again, one might think. But we see both within the novel, The Great Gatsby, and in contemporary United States, that there is a kind of upsurge of violent wishes to go back to a time that I think maybe most people thought had already vanished.
Well, we are talking history, and tonight we are talking about The Great Gatsby, which was published 100 years ago. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be finding out about how the novel critiques the American dream. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about The Great Gatsby on this, the 100th anniversary of its publication. My brilliant panel of experts, Professor Philip McGowan of Queen's University Belfast. He's the editor of the expanded Penguin Classics version of The Great Gatsby, which is going to be published in April. Also rejoined by Dr. Alexandra Peat, who teaches in the School of English Media and Creative Arts at the University of Galway and is an expert on modernism, and Professor Kirk Kernut, the Professor of English at Troy University in Alabama and Executive Director of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Society. Kirk, can we talk about the American dream and how it's presented in the novel, how it's in some ways, you know, ostensibly celebrated, but really being critiqued and challenged in the way that really so much of this is built on an illusion, and that money can't really buy legitimacy or love or happiness, and that so many of these myths are presented and then deconstructed?
Yes, well, it's an excellent question. I should tell you that I think most of us who teach Gatsby or teach Fitzgerald, the phrase we really loathe more than anything else showing up in student papers is the American dream, because we tend to use this phrase without really defining what we mean for ourselves. We have a wonderful colleague, Sarah Churchwell, who wrote a book a few years ago in which she traced the sort of historical correspondences between this phrase, the American dream, and the idea of America first. And it really was an eye-opener to me, to the point where I don't allow my students to use that phrase, the American dream, anymore. I sort of challenge them to come up with something else. But that said, we have this term by which what we understand is something very different from what the dream of America was originally. America was supposed to be a representative democracy with egalitarian and equality, at least for some, and the idea that you had the freedom to pursue your own sort of economic upbringing. And one of the things we see that happens in the 1920s is that phrase begins to mean something else. It begins to be more about acquisition. It means to be more about Theodore Veblen called pecuniary emulation, where we define our self-worth by how competitive we are with other people in terms of what sort of flash and spectacle we can create around our lives. I think of all of the people who are online endlessly trying to prove they live exotic existences as influencers. That's one of the ways in which this pecuniary emulation still exists. So you're exactly right that the myth of America is that we can invent ourselves and we can be whoever we want to be. But the reality is that sort of ambition always comes up against networks of influence, of nepotism, nepo babies, to use a contemporary phrase. And we know that real wealth is usually concentrated in the hands of very few. And in most cases, if they are not entrepreneurs that are building generational wealth for their children, that they come from generational wealth. So the tragedy of Gatsby is he buys into this notion that you can be whoever you want to be. And the idea that it's okay if you have money, even if it's through illegal means, because what's important is that you've made it. And I think one of the interesting things about the novel is the way that it really captures, you know, the gangster ethos. And the gangster ethos of Al Capone and all the mafioso was very much, I mean, that was unbridled capitalism in action.
And Kurt, do you think that it shows that this myth that you can be, you can rise up from nothing, you don't have to be born into wealth, you can make it in America, and it kind of undermines that by showing that Gatsby isn't really accepted because of the way he made his money, because of those connections, and that things sure. like class and inherited wealth still prevail and are more powerful?
Well, I do think that it shows that. You know, there were a lot of people in the 1920s that did make a lot of money off of the stock market, off of bootlegging. Was it legit, quote unquote, legitimate money? The reality is when we usually go back into the history of a influential family, there's at some point a generation where that wealth is dubious. The question of how did you acquire all of that? So the notions of legitimacy usually comes through a few generations of wealth being handed down. I think for most of my students, what's really interesting is they don't necessarily think that those networks of influence are still around today. They tend to want to buy more into the entrepreneurial idea because of all of the people like Elon Musk and the tech bros that are out there that really did create their own wealth in a lot of ways. But what they don't talk about is, you know, what are the institutions that enabled them and how did they wield their influence? And so there's simply no way that Gatsby was ever going to get Daisy back. You know, there's a fantasy at some point late in the novel where they talk about that she would leave Tom and they would go back to Louisville and they would sort of go back to 1917 and start all over. And you just realize the world is completely against them and that there's no way Daisy can leave the privilege that she's been born to sort of embody for somebody who is, you know, doing some criminal things.
And Philip, following on from what Kirk is saying about how sometimes it takes a few generations for this to become respectable, you know, in a way, Gatsby had to give up on his dream of winning back Daisy and just think about maybe he might have a son or a grandson who might become president of the United States or something, because in a few years' time, it would all be whitewashed and respectable.
Yeah, Gatsby is an extraordinarily interesting character in many ways, but also a very empty character. It's the way Fitzgerald sets the novel up, that we sort of invest so much time and energy in sort of trying to understand Gatsby, but he is a kind of, he's in many ways an empty token of a different sense of possibilities and urges within the text. Like once we see through him, and we do see through Gatsby quite quickly, that it's quite an empty dream, and part of the problem of it, that he has this desire to get back with Daisy, is Daisy herself is represented. You know, the main thing she is connected with, as Kirk has said, is wealth and a social position. And it's Gatsby who puts his finger on this when he says that her voice is full of money. And suddenly when he says that, Nick Carraway goes, oh, of course, yes, that's what it is. That, like, she is a currency in the text, and his attempt to rebuy that or reclaim that with money that is achieved and accumulated through nefarious means, it's always never going to work in the text. And Gatsby, for himself, you know, it is only a sort of solipsistic enterprise in terms of how he's going to make this dream happen. There's no sense of a legacy for Gatsby afterwards, you know, in terms of like a family, or you know, he's kind of, he finds it very odd when he sees Daisy's actual child in the text. He just doesn't quite think there should have been one somehow. He hasn't put two and two together to realize that Tom and Daisy have actually had a child. So Gatsby is a remarkably odd character in this novel, I think.
And Alexandra, it's not just the American dream, it's dreams in general, and a lot of false dreams in the text, and a lot of pursuits that really just seem to be not really there at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's interesting that Fitzgerald wrote this book, which is so much about America, and when he wasn't actually, or he drafted much of it when he wasn't actually living in America. He was living as an expatriate in the French Riviera, and he, you know, after he wrote the novel, he also spent a lot of time in France. So I think there's a sense that did he have to leave America perhaps to see it clearly. But also with this idea of these false dreams or false promises, I was listening to what Kirk and Philip were saying, and that the phrase in the novel that kept on coming to my mind was this idea of carelessness and this idea of careless people. And towards the end of the novel, after Gatsby's died, Nick describes Tom and Daisy as careless people who could retreat back into their wealth and retreat back into their privilege. So I think it's this idea also of like who gets to have the kind of security of their dreams, and who gets to kind of play around. Like, you know, Daisy gets to flirt with the idea of perhaps running off with Gatsby, and then in the end she can kind of retreat back into the security of her world, which isn't, I don't think, a necessarily particularly happy world, because as we've established, like, Tom is fairly misogynist and cruel to her. But there's also this sense of I think the way in which the smaller people in this world are often crushed by their dreams and crushed by these sort of false promises.
And Alexandra, Nick is an unreliable narrator, and that adds a layer of ambiguity to the story, and it probably reflects some of these modernist, or it is an example of some of those modernist techniques that Fitzgerald is using.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the whole novel, like, we have to understand this is Nick's story, and I think the question of whether this is a novel about Gatsby or whether this is a novel about Nick is a really fascinating one. And also, you know, Kirk talked about how much we can see elements of Fitzgerald in Gatsby, but I think we can also see elements of Fitzgerald in Nick. You know, the boy who always felt a little bit of an outsider, the young man who went to Princeton and described himself as having his kind of face pressed against the window, watching the wealthier the people and the more privileged people. So I think that, you know, this idea of Nick, like, yes, he's an unreliable narrator, but he's also, I think, very kind of increasingly conscious about the fact that he is telling a story that is about his own dreams and about his own kind of infatuation with this world that as I think it was Philip who said, both attracts and repulses him. And so I think that the question of how much we can trust Nick, and he begins by telling us he's extremely trustworthy, and you know, you can never completely trust someone who has to reassure you of their own trustworthiness all the time. But I think I think in some ways he is kind of telling himself a story to try and make himself feel better about everything he's witnessed. But I think he's also quite self-conscious about his own limitations or his own anxieties or his own desires.
And Kirk, do you think that Fitzgerald was more interested in producing great literature? Did he want to make money? I'm curious about the fact that he then went off and tried to become a screenwriter and that didn't really work out. That did he want to reach a mass audience? Was he interested in making his fortune, or was he looking for literary fame?
Well, I think with Gatsby, he was clearly aiming to knock one out of the park. And again, it's a moment of artistic maturity for him where he realizes I've built a reputation and have something of an audience, but it's a young audience. You know, there's a moment where he wants to be taken more seriously. So he devotes himself to craft and he produces this novel. I think his struggle was he wanted both. He wanted to be both a popular writer and to be critically esteemed. And I think in the 1920s, there were certainly models for that. Most of them kind of antedated Fitzgerald. But Ernest Hemingway struggled with the same sort of thing. As And the reality is if you want to be an artist, at times part of your job is to alienate your audience and to take those kinds of risks. So I think probably I've always thought that the main struggle that he had was he overestimated his innards, and he told himself, well, I can crank out commercial short stories to support myself, and then I'll go write a novel. And I think he tried to compartmentalize those two aspects of his, sort of impulses. And it's just hard to do. I mean, it is very difficult to write commercial fiction and then turn around and write literary fiction at the same time. You have to be of two minds, and I don't think many people are. Screenwriting was another means to an end for him. And I don't believe he ever took the time to really understand the process or the nature of a script that would have made him like Dorothy Parker or Anita Loos, to where he could just go in and play with the form and crank something out. He was always pushing himself to be the greater artist, and I think that foiled him in a lot of ways.
Philip Fitzgerald died in December 1940, so a year before the United States entered the Second World War. And it seems that it was during that period where the novel, it reached a new audience, it achieved a new acclaim. And I'm just wondering, why wasn't it more highly regarded in 1925? Why were some critics not blown away by it? Why didn't audiences react so well to it? And in a way, why did it take, maybe 20 years or almost 20 years before it received the audience and the recognition that Fitzgerald had wanted?
I think in part it goes back to some of what Kirk is saying. Fitzgerald arrives on the scene as a short story writer and then as a novelist in 1920. His first novel, This Side of Paradise, is received with great acclaim, and he has found an audience, and it's a very young audience. It's a very vibrant and dynamic and an audience that is looking for a kind of new voice, a new voice for their generation. And he found them and he identified them with This Side of Paradise. But the audience moves on quite quickly. And Fitzgerald himself, as he tries to write this novel, which is a bit more literary than the first two novels are, they are really interesting texts in and of themselves, but they're not of a piece with Gatsby. So critics, when Gatsby comes out in 1925, the reviews are variable. They're not all completely negative. It's pretty well received. He has established a niche within the market. But the things that set him apart in 1920 with This Side of Paradise and 1922 with The Beautiful and Damned, he had moved beyond them, and the audience itself had grown up maybe expecting that Fitzgerald would keep on producing this kind of formula Fitzgerald fiction, and he himself had moved past that. So there's a kind of a divide in the road between Fitzgerald and his immediate audience with this text. I also think that Fitzgerald himself, in letters and correspondence, had noted that possibly the Jazz Age had already peaked by the time the novel comes out. So some of the questions that it's talking about and looking at have maybe already been considered and moved beyond. So Fitzgerald finds himself in an odd moment of flux, I think, in the mid-1920s, and Alexandra also pointed this out. Like, he writes most of this novel while he's in the Riviera. He's in Europe for a lot of the 1920s. He's also beginning to deal with some of the issues within his own personal life and his marriage. So it is an extraordinary moment of flux for Fitzgerald at this point in his life.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we are talking about The Great Gatsby on this, the centenary of its publication. We'll take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be assessing the legacy and impact of Gatsby. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about The Great Gatsby on this, the centenary of its publication. I'm rejoined by Professor Philip McGowan, Dr. Alexandra Peter, and Professor Kirk Kernot. Alexandra, can I talk about race again? Because, Gatsby himself is connected with black culture. There's so much anxiety in the novel about race, and we've talked about some of that. I've read some theories that Gatsby himself is a black man, and that he's hiding his identity, and that there's maybe coded references to that. It does very much seem to be a significant theme in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kirk pointed out that scene where they're traveling across the bridge to New York, and they see a limousine, and the limousine is driven by a white driver, and it has three black passengers in it, and Nick kind of looks with astonishment and he says, oh, you know, if this could happen, anything can happen, as if the, this kind of image of racial and class inversion is both kind of exciting and really disturbing to him. And I think, you know, we can't avoid the fact that Fitzgerald has said in his letters and in his journals some quite racist things and was, you know, espousing views that we would find, I think, quite repellent now, and was at times quite attracted himself by theories of the sort of Nordic race and white supremacy. But I think the novel is more complicated than that. I think novels sometimes know more than their authors. There are spaces where their authors are working things out. And he does give the most racist views in the book to Tom, a not particularly attractive character. And he also, I think that the novel is sort of drawing attention to anxieties about race. And you mentioned Gatsby as perhaps being, you know, ethnically ambiguous in some ways. And I think that there's a comment that Tom makes where he refers to his relationship with Daisy in terms of miscegenation. There's also the suggestion, I think some critics have said, that perhaps there's a suggestion that Gatsby could be Jewish because the name Gats could be German or German-Jewish in origin. So I think there's this kind of uncertainty. We can't pin down or trace we can't answer the question about Gatsby's racial ambiguity or ethnic ambiguity, but he's definitely positioned in ways that sort of evoke these questions, which I think is fascinating. But I think that it also one of the things that we might think about Gatsby in terms of is this notion of passing, right? What it means to pass as something that you're not. So is he passing as white? Is he passing as rich? Is he passing as more upper class than he actually is? And there is a suggestion of a kind of fraudulence. And I think that the novel, in ways that I think are both conscious from Fitzgerald and perhaps also sometimes not quite conscious, is working through a lot of anxieties about race. And then to turn to this question of the novel's Americanness, about the place of race in relation to American identity.
Philip, how do your students respond to The Great Gatsby, and has that changed over time?
That's a very good question. You have to get them beyond a sense of this concept of the American dream. A lot of our students will have done The Great Gatsby either at Leaving Cert in Ireland or A-levels in the UK system. This book is something that you can keep going back to and finding ways in and back routes into some of the issues that Fitzgerald is talking about that then do have relevance to contemporary readers. So I think one of the things that students really like about the novel is it's very accessible. It's an easy read. It's a beautifully constructed text. But there's a kind of treasure trove of information that Fitzgerald has left for us to find in it.
Kirk, I wonder, how do you feel about some of the cinematic representations of the novel? There is the famous adaptation, Robert Redford played Gatsby.
How do you do, old sport? I'm Gatsby. Nick Carraway, it's a pleasure. You live in the cottage across the lawn. I tried to buy it once. I've been trying to find you, but I'm afraid I'm not a very good host. Truth of the matter is, I don't much like parties.
More recently, Leonardo DiCaprio playing Gatsby.
I knew you looked familiar, having a good time, old sport.
Oh, the whole thing's incredible. I live just next door. He sent me an actual invitation. Seems I'm the only one. I still haven't met Mr. Gatsby.
No one's met him. They say he's third cousin to the Kaiser, second cousin to the devil.
I'm afraid I haven't been a very good host, old sport. You see, I'm Gatsby.
And I wonder, do any of the film adaptations, do any of the stage adaptations capture, I suppose, the nuance and ambiguity and greatness of the novel?
Well, let me say first that I think adaptations play an important role in introducing text to audiences that may not remember reading a novel back in high school or their college years. So I think there's a place for them. I will say that of the four adaptations that have been done, and I think most of them have really struggled, and it boils down to Fitzgerald wrote prose. And that prose, those scenes are not necessarily realistically rendered. There's a lot of dialogue, a lot of action. But he's not trying to create a visual world so much as he is trying to create a lyrical world, and it's very sumptuous. And it all depends upon analogies and similes that can, when you break down, feel pretty far out. There's no way a cinematographer can come in and look at the Buchanan's ceiling and, you know, Fitzgerald describes it as a frosted wedding cake of a ceiling. Well, how do you depict that in a movie, you know? How do you bring off that sort of magical nature of the prose? So I think that, one of the things that happens is you get a lot of voiceover where characters are reading Fitzgerald's prose because it's just so good. I mean, there's no way to film this wonderful closing passage, one of the most famous passages in literature. You can't visually represent that. You have to rely on an actor reading those words. And so I think that's really the struggle with any kind of adaptation is that, you know, Fitzgerald at the end of the day was a novelist and he worked in a medium that was verbal. And we have to be willing to best appreciate it. We have to be willing to sort of immerse ourselves into that verbal world.
And Philip, a lot of the nuance and a lot of the complexity is lost, and you only need to Google Great Gatsby Ball to see the numbers of societies in Ireland and in other colleges around the world that when they want to run a 1920s themed ball, it's called after Gatsby, and there are Gatsby parties, and it's very much a celebration of the jazz age and the roaring 20s, but it's not really engaging with any of the issues that we've been talking about.
No, Gatsby is a byword for excess and for parties and for spectacle. That's part of the challenge of the novel in some ways. Yeah, like it has endured. It's 100 years old, but some of the kind of immediate interpretations of it in terms of those kind of parties and excess that has kind of got in the way of what Fitzgerald was doing with this text. It's a complicated, very complex novel in which he immerses us within an American culture that is both finding its feet after war, but is also riven with division, with questions about identity, identity politics, looking at what America is trying to become in the wake of international turmoil.
And perhaps, Philip, the best way of celebrating or commemorating the centenary of the book is to just take it out and read it or reread it and deciding for yourself what you think of the work.
Yes, absolutely. I think people need to read the book, re-engage with the book and think about it within the context of 2025 as well as they read the novel, and to see, like we started this conversation looking at some of the cross currents between 1925 and 2025. And it's remarkable how, if history doesn't quite repeat, it definitely echoes, and you can hear the echoes of it from today as you read back through the novel.
Well, I think that's an excellent note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for bringing the 1920s to life for our listeners, but also very much F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic, The Great Gatsby. My thanks to Professor Philip McGann of Queen's University Belfast, Dr. Alexandra Peat of the University of Galway, and Professor Kirk Kernott, Professor of English at Troy University in Alabama, and Executive Director of the F. Scott Fitzgerald Society. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.